So today's a little bit different. No in-depth Bible study or anything, but hopefully you'll get something from this other than just information. Have you all seen that While You Were Out show? While you're out, and then somebody comes into comes into some room, and they do a drastic rearrangement of that room. That happened to me while I was out. Ange and Lori completely changed my office, and much for the better. They got a new desk, a nice wood desk, and completely painted the office, organized my books, and there is a map on my wall that covers the whole wall and one side of another wall, and it's a map of Turkey, the Middle East, all the way from Jerusalem, all the way up around to Rome. It's pretty cool. It has the cities listed there.
Hand-drawn.
Not freehand, I don't think, but hand, some of it. Yeah. All those names. And it's awesome, though. And then there's pictures. I can never do anything that looks this cool, but I guess Ange has that ability. There's pictures scattered completely over the whole map of different mission trips and stuff that we've done. And it really looks cool. So tonight y'all can come check it out. And then there's two sayings written on the wall. Do you remember the sayings, Ange?
One is wherever you are, be out there, lift up every
situation, you need to be able to God. And the other one is world that gets to see what God can do in and through, form with a man's voice. It's cool. It's as Carlton said when he came in, that it's inspiring. And it is. So I appreciated that. Okay, I have to teach y'all one Turkish word. Okay? What should it be, Carlton? We better go with merhaba, not that other one. Don't you think? Okay. Merhaba. Can you say that?
Merhaba.
Okay, one, two, three.
Merhaba.
Merhaba. Hello. If you want one more, when somebody comes to your home, you say, Hoş geldiniz. Hoş geldiniz. It comes in handy. Hoş geldiniz. Hoş geldiniz. And then the return to that is Hoş bulduk. And that is... there's some worse ones than that.
Hoş geldiniz.
But it's more than that.
Yeah, it means more. It means like your coming is good.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Your coming is a good thing.
Yeah.
And then Hoş geldiniz means it's kind of an agreement. It's good to be coming.
Yeah. it's an unusual culture in that they have all these they have these kind of formalities, but they don't feel formal. They feel, it's kind of neat. You come in and like at one of the seminars that we were at, every time when everybody come in, every single person would come in, they'd come around, they would shake your hand, and if they thought you were ready for it, they'd give you the kiss on each side on the cheek, and you would say, Hoş geldiniz, and they'd say, Hoş bulduk, and you'd say, merhaba, and that would offend them, and this thank you, and all this kind of little official back and forth that everybody says every time they see each other. But it was neat. kind of a very verbal society. I mean, they want... Carlton and I were talking about this earlier, that as soon as you... it's almost like you can feel... Are we okay here, John? Is that better? Is that better? Okay. I can't help that. I think it was just a massive chest. Sorry. Where was I? The culture has so many paradoxes. It's like you ride the bus somewhere, and if somebody gets off to get lunch and they were sitting next to you, when they come back, they'll have something for you too. You may not have said a word to them. Like, I was sitting on the bus with this old guy, and he comes back, sits down on the bus, and he opens up his little pretzel bread thing, and he opens it up, and he sits on the seat and kind of pushes it over towards me, you know, like, go ahead, have some. And it's not just a empty offer. He expects you to eat some. And but at the same time, if you park in the wrong place in front of their shop, then they'll argue to the death. You know, it could be a major ordeal. You're going to have some, you know, argue what?
High intensity
talking. And like, that goes for the police and everybody. The police pull you over or something and you don't think it was right, there's not this official thing if you don't get in their face. It's like, yeah, you get in their face and they get in your face, and then somebody has to back down or else there's going to be trouble. So it's kind of odd. But once you break the ice and talk, it's like they just want to befriend you. So everywhere, when I was out on my own, like I was a couple times, like on a long bus ride and through the airport, I knew if I could just find somebody I could kind of just connect with, if I couldn't figure out how things worked, then I knew I was home free then, because they would take me wherever I needed to go and do it graciously. Like, just lead you around, point you in the right direction, help you in any way they could. But at the same time, you can slip over into trouble pretty easy too. Something about that culture is different. But anyway, I left Salt Lake City 6 a.m. on Wednesday the 28th, and got into Ankara on Thursday afternoon about 3:30. They picked me up, Matt and the missionary Dan, and a guy, John, from their church, another American guy, picked me up. We went straight to the church. The church in Ankara, where we were going to spend the next 2 weeks, is kind of looks like a storefront type of a building, sort of in a almost an industrial-looking area. No place really looks nice. Turkey's kind of not really third world, but it's not really first world either, sort of somewhere in between. But there's no sign out front. They're not allowed to put a church sign out front. But yet, they kind of sort of are allowed to meet in a public place like that. They harass them a little bit from time to time, but they're really battling to become official status, to get official status as a church. They also have a bookstore right in the front that's kind of a ministry, because everybody knows that they're there. They don't have a sign, but everybody kind of knows they're there. And people will regularly, Muslim people will regularly stop in. And they'll either have been, it'll either be like a woman that has, that's just sick of being mistreated and just looking for an answer, just some hope. Or somebody that wants to debate and is questioning, and they want to debate. And so they'll come in and argue between Muslim and Christianity. And a lot of people have come to know the Lord in that fashion. So anyway, we started that night at 7 o'clock, Thursday night. Matt had already been teaching, discipleship training, and started the Firm Foundations. I picked up with the Firm Foundations and really taught most of the rest of the Firm Foundations. That weekend, we traveled to, we got up Saturday morning, and we traveled to a village, Göçekaya, which is up in the mountains. You go to a town, Eskişehir, which is to the west of Ankara. Ankara is kind of north, middle of Turkey. Eskişehir is to the west towards Istanbul, about halfway to Istanbul, and there's this gravel road that goes on for miles and miles and miles up into the mountains, and it's just this beautiful place up in the mountains, this river, just rushing river coming down through the village, and it's really a nice, it's really a neat looking place. There's about 100 houses there in the village. Not huts, they're houses. Not quite as nice as the houses in town. Certainly not as nice as the houses we live in. They have running water. I don't think they had any hot water in the village. Did they have hot? I didn't see any showers in the village. Did you call them? Most, they have there's a main room and two or three bedrooms. And most every place had a wood stove in the main room, and that room was shut off from every place else. They kept that because it was really a small wood stove in almost every place we were. And on every wood stove is a cool looking pot of water. And then on top of that, nestled into that, is a pot of tea. And that's always there, ready to go. And as soon as you come in, they grab them, get a glass out, they pour the tea in, then they add the water till it's the right strength, then you drop two sugar cubes in there, and you drink gallons and gallons of that stuff while you're there. But it's good. They definitely are hospitable. When you're in their home, you belong to them, and you're protected. When you're in their home, nobody messes with you. Nobody can hassle you. They'll die for you, really. So once you get in the home, it's good. Now we were there. We were going to do some medical clinics. Gochikaya is an absolutely, completely Muslim village, and Matt has run into some trouble there before, being kind of open with the gospel. And so we were going to, for the sake of the family we were with, we were just going to do a medical clinic, not get into any big deals. But the weekend we were there was called, Lori's passing around some pictures here if y'all want to take a look at them. It was called Bairam, and it's their annual sacrifice. So they, every family takes a lamb, and you see these lambs coming on trucks going to everywhere. Every family takes a lamb, they, right out there by the front door, they sacrifice this lamb. They kill it and they hang it in the doorway, which is a little unusual to have this thing. They're hanging this lamb that they're butchering right in the doorway. There's some significance to that. But, you know, as many people as I asked, why do you do this? I wondered if they had some sort of a concept of substitution, you know, like Christ's substitutional death on the cross. If they had some sort of, and they just hadn't, they were waiting, and they just didn't have a full understanding of it yet, that could be sort of a lead-in to sharing with them. But most of them had no concept of what it meant that they were doing. It had been lost over time. Now, some people say that it means that they think that it was not Isaac that Abraham put on the altar. They think it was Ishmael that Abraham put on the altar. And so it's sort of a symbolic of Ishmael that they sacrificed this lamb. Oh, yeah. And the family we were staying with was Muslim, too. Now, there's one guy there, maybe Carlton remembers his name, that Shefet. Shefket is the guy that lives in the house, but there's a guy that Matt had spent about 8 hours sharing the gospel with the last time. And you remember Carlton told the story of he had shared the whole thing at the Firm Foundations, and he there was the chasm separating God and man, and Matt had put the cross and said the cross of Jesus bridges the gap between God and man. And this guy just leaped out on the floor and grabbed that up and threw it away. And what did he say, Carlton?
There was
Muhammad. It's Muhammad that bridges the gap. He was like excited about that, intense about it. Anyway, he had wanted a Bible, so we brought him a Bible. And before we left, we called him into the back room in private and gave him this Bible, put it in a bag so nobody would see it when he headed out into the village to his home. So he hid it in this little bag, and he carried the Bible home. We did do a few medical things while we were there, although it was pretty much disrupted by the Bairam celebration. Now, we got up Saturday morning, and we just heard this uproar outside our window. Now, we were right next to the mosque, and there was this, just, you know how you hear this roar from a crowd just kind of rising up? And Matt and I were, woke up and I looked at Matt and I said, are they doing the sacrifice? I don't know. He said, maybe they decided to sacrifice the Christians today. So we snuck up to the window to peek out the window. Were they like out our window waiting for us, or what are they doing? And they were just out there in this long line, the whole village just greeting one another, kissing and saying Merhaba and Norse Geldenes and whatever else they say. So they were just having a celebration. And what it's really, it ends up being for them, it's almost like Thanksgiving. They have time off from work. All the families get together. They have a big feast. We ate some of their lamb that they sacrificed. It was an unusual thing. So anyway, we weren't able to have a big medical clinic like we had hoped, because everybody's families were there. They were busy, but they did have some relatives in the next village, so that needed to see a doctor. So it was late at night, but that never stops Matt. So we loaded up and headed off to this next village, and we did three or four or five people came in, and we had a little miniature clinic up there at their house. You'll see a picture in there of a young lady holding up her finger, and Matt's working on it. She had cut her hand being a part of the butchering of the lamb, and he gave it, put a couple stitches in her hand while we were there. So anyway, we left, we left from Gochikaya, and not really thinking that that's going to be a focus if we come back. It's a good contact to maintain, some relationships that we need to continue, but not really worth a complete trip to Turkey for. So we went back to Ankara, continued the final week of Firm Foundations. And it was an interesting week, and we learned a lot, and they learned a lot, but still did not feel like this is the place that we need to come back to. We still didn't have this assurance that we can really be of assistance here. Now, we heard some neat things. There were some testimonies that are pretty amazing. There's a few different groups in Turkey. It's everybody belongs to some group, it seems like. You have the Shiites, who are more radical Muslims. You have the Sunnis, which are less, I think I have it right, less radical. You have fundamentalist Muslims. You have the more liberal, like the professors and stuff from the colleges. And then you have nationalists, which they are Muslims, but their focus is not on religion. Their focus is on Turkey. They think as long as you're Turkish, you're a little step above everybody else. And then there's the communists, who are become smaller now, but still there's a group that are kind of loyal to that. And they all kind of argue between each other whenever they have any kind of discussions. But there was one guy there that was a radical Muslim that was coming to the seminar. And he was not a Christian, but he used to be a more radical Muslim, and he had been known to kill for Islam. He's killed two or three people in the name of Muhammad. And so I'd be teaching along, and he'd raise his hand, and I'd go, yeah. And it's interesting to have an argument with a guy through a translator. But we had some discussions. And he got mad and was storming out. And so I stopped him and just said, you know, why don't you just hear us out? And, you know, maybe you'll learn something. And then afterwards, I'll hear you out. And so why don't you just stay? And I'd really like you to hear this. And he said, okay. And he sat down and stayed and didn't have anything else to say. He came about four nights. So that was a fairly interesting interacting with him. But most of the people, everybody there was from a Muslim background. And everybody we could, we just asked them, how did you come to know the Lord? You know, tell us your story. And they all had varying things, but most all of them received some sort of persecution when they came to know the Lord. Soner, our translator, Soner at first, the first week, he was just a translator. When we went to Gochikaya together, we really had a chance to talk with him, see where his heart was. He talked to us. And when we came back from Gochukaya, he was no longer a translator. He really was a partner. And we really were like-minded. It was him and I, and Matt and him and I. We really, any decision we made, we said, well, you're a part of the team. We'll just make everything in unity. And we prayed about everything. And so he really became a partner and a friend, not just a translator. But his story, I'll tell you exactly how he came to know the Lord a little later. But when he came to know God, wasn't it his brother that beat him up? His brother was like a boxer. And his brother put him in the hospital. And then a separate time, he had shared with somebody who was buying a paper. And it wasn't the radical Muslim paper. It was a more liberal paper. And then somehow it came, he shared with the guy that he was a Christian. And the guy said, well, let's have some tea and we'll talk about it. And then he left and he came back with 10 guys and they beat him up, put him in the hospital for days. They really hurt him. And a number of people had some similar stories as this. But what I found, these people are, they're still willing. They're so alert to the darkness around them. They're not numb to it. It's like when I was there, I really felt it. This coldness, I mean, oppressive type of feeling. And they're not afraid. I mean, I'm not saying that all of them are not afraid, but most of them are not afraid. It's always on their mind to share the gospel. They have a light that they want to go into the world. And that was challenging. It definitely was challenging. And Dan, the missionary there, most of the missionaries that I ran into, you had to be very careful not to call him a missionary. You had to be very careful not to say church. He didn't care. He did not care. He said, we're here and everybody can know it. And he was bold. And he's been harassed a little bit for it, but definitely an inspiration. but still, there were some things there at the church at Ankara that we felt like it wasn't quite a good fit for us. They were already moving in a direction. There were some. We felt like that there needed to be more. Plurality of leadership, more encouragement of not just the one person leading the way, but they definitely are doing the work. It was a challenge to see what they were doing. So we left from there, and on a Friday morning, and we headed to Antakya, a village outside of Antakya. You cross over the Taurus Mountains, which is a big mountain pass, and they're jagged peaks and snow. I mean, it's beautiful. And there's villages up there that's just completely snow covered, and it's really a beautiful place. When you go over the pass, as soon as you go over the top of the pass, you start heading down. Everything turns green, and after a while, you come to like an overlook, and you see the Mediterranean out there, and you see the olive orchards and the farms, and it really is it's a beautiful sight. It's about a 10-hour drive to Antakya, and we met the pastor there, just a humble, gentle man, Salim, and he lives in he has a carpenter shop. He's a carpenter, is what he does for a living, and he has a shop underneath his house, and then he lives on top of that in his house, and then there's another house on top of that. That's where his brother and his brother's family lives. And so they interact, and it's sort of a community almost there. Well, the first Saturday night we started the seminar, and we just felt like something was different about this place. You know, we were told that all over Turkey, you know, there are very few. Most of the churches are 7 people, 10 people. In the bigger, really big cities, there's a couple of churches that are a little bit larger. but there's just not that many churches scattered across Turkey. But that first night of the seminar, there were 20 people, over 20 people at the seminar. And we never had less than 20 people at the seminar. The next day was Sunday morning, and they have a house church. And so we were And I was going to preach at the service. And we went to somebody, another person's house for this service. And there were like 40 people packed in this house. And it was the worship time. It was just real. You know, they started up their church 10 years ago. And without a plan, Salim says, God just did it. We didn't really come out. We just didn't really set out to plan a church. It just happened. And people have just started just gradually coming to know the Lord. But one thing they lack that we discovered, what we were doing was exactly their need, is teaching and equipping. They just have no training, basically. And so that's really the area we feel like we can be of assistance to them. But the service was it's just one guy playing a guitar, and they sang a couple songs in Arabic, which is their primary language, and they speak fluent Turkish, but Arabic is right on the Syrian border where they are, and Arabic is really their language they speak at home. And so I taught on the family. I did kind of the stuff we've been talking about, marriage and the family, and just sort of condensed that, and we did the five languages of love. And it really, according to Salim and Soner, that it really hit home with them, and particularly to the men. I really picked the men out and talked to them about their families and their responsibilities and if they were showing love to their wives. And most of them, it's a weakness to show love. And that, so what if their culture says one thing? The Bible says something else, and they're Christians, and that they need to go by what the Bible says. And they were really responsive to that. Now, in the Christian, they've been Christians for a while, and so it's not nearly the same cultural thing as you find elsewhere in Turkey. But still, there is this thing of not really showing love to their families. And so we talked about that being the foundation, like we have here, the foundation for the church. And this village that where they are is there's a little more freedom there. There's about two villages in Turkey that are kind of classified as Christian in name. It's really they're Orthodox, which is a similar church to Catholic, but they're really not. There would be very few people there that would be sincere, that would really sincere Christians. But they still have a little bit more freedom. And their culture is a shade different than a lot of the rest of Turkey. There is more of a warmth in the family and stuff like that. But the mother, wife of the home, Miriam, she took us out in the backyard to where they have this shed, and they have this fire pit. It's like an L-shaped kind of a cement and rock kind of a counter underneath just like a metal shed. And they just take sticks and brush, and they throw them into this pit, and they get it just a roaring fire going in there. And then while she's got the fire going, she's just kneading and working this bread and makes it into these balls and pats it out and puts it on this like a cushion thing, and then just slaps it onto the wall where the fire is, where it's hot, and it just sticks there. And then when you can tell when it starts bubbling up, it's done, and she just peels it off and throws it on this pan that she has there, and it's ready to go. So she let us be a part of the bread making. The whole thing of food and eating there is just phenomenal. The effort and time that they put into that is just phenomenal. They have the olive trees in the back, and they pick their own olives, they make their own olive oil, they make soap out of the olive oil, which I took a bath with this morning. they have pomegranates, they have all kinds of vegetables, the cheese is homemade, the butter is homemade, everything they make right there. They grind up seeds. It's just amazing, and the food is just awesome. It is really good. It definitely reminded me of eating with the Abrahams, and as you know, they're of Syrian descent. and the food was all, a lot of the things were the same. And so I kind of wanted them to think I knew what I was talking about. So they were, I'd communicated sort of that I knew what kibbeh was, which Lori makes all the time. And I said, I told them I knew, I asked them if they ate kibbeh nai. And kibbeh nai is like, same as kibbeh, but it's not cooked. It's lamb and bulgur and spices, but they don't cook it. So it has the raw lamb in there. And they said, and they were excited. I knew what kibbeh nai was. And so she says, well, I'll make you some. And I'm going, I'm trying to, well, I'd rather, I like the cooked kind. The cooked kind is what I really like. So at the next night, Matt and Stoner were not around. So she made me special, some kibbeh nai. And she called me into the kitchen to watch her working that lamb into the bulgur and working it and working it in that big old wooden bowl about this big. And then she takes these, rolls them into these like just cylinder things, you know, just sort of red looking, and I guess from the raw meat, and slaps it on the big pan with a whole stack of them. And I was thinking, maybe she's going to put it in the oven for like a few minutes before we eat dinner. But nope. Steve, kibbeh nai. So I had one of them. As long as you dipped it in that onion stuff they had there, it was not too bad. Problem is, everybody dips out of the same bowl. You know that thing about Jesus sitting at the table and saying, the one that dips his hand in the bowl with me is the one that... Well, that's because they all dip out of the same bowl. And then I always wondered with Lori's family why they never put drinks on the table. Her mom always... And Lori does the same thing. She forgets to put drinks on the table. It always aggravates me. And now I realize where it comes from, because they don't put drinks on the table. But then all of a sudden they'll realize, oh, they need some drinks. And they'll put like... 2 glasses out and there's 10 people. But even for the seminar, there's 25 people and they put a pitcher of water and 2 glasses. And so everybody uses those 2 glasses. So I'd always snag mine early. Just a few little interesting things. But some of the stuff that she made was like the grape leaves that they had got out of the yard. What do they put in grape leaves, Lori? Rice and lamb. Boy, they were good. And what else did she make? She made the leb rice like Lori makes. All kind of salads, tomatoes and cucumbers. And the salads were just awesome. Grilled lamb, lentil soup. I mean, we had this major full course meal every time we sat down. Now, they would sit at the table while we were there, but we must have got more comfortable because by the last day, we're sitting on the floor and eating, because that's where they eat. They spread out a tablecloth on the floor, spread all the stuff around, and sit on the floor and eat. You need to be flexible or it's not very comfortable. So, I forgot if I told you that... the message after I taught on the Sunday morning, Sonar interpreted, and then after I got through, and after Sonar had interpreted, after we got through, then Salim, he had been taking notes while I was teaching, and then he just retaught the whole message in Arabic, because there was about 3 people there that didn't speak Turkish. All they spoke was Arabic. Then during the day we would do the medical clinics during the day, which we definitely could have used some help there, because it was just, the people will just keep coming and keep coming, and it's like all day long they're just coming to, I mean, they have doctors, but they just don't have easy access to doctors. But there were all kinds of, you know, we at the medical clinic we did in the village, most of their problems had to do, you should have been there, and it was physical therapy. So I'm teaching all these women that are out working in the fields all day how to do stretches for their back and stuff before they go into the fields in the morning. And this one was just a little bit different, but we ran into some things that were, you know, some pretty serious medical problems. I was taking one lady's blood pressure, and it's like, Matt, listen, I've never heard a heartbeat like this. It, you know, there was something just something did not sound right. And so, and she did, Matt discovered she had a serious, serious heart problem that he was had to refer her to somebody else. There was another lady there that she walked in with the long skirt, and I didn't notice anything. She didn't notice anything about her, but later when I went into the examining room, and she didn't have any feet. Her feet had been burned off when she was like a year old. She had gotten into the fire, and she, no prosthetics, no. But she was walking around, so just these nubs. It was horrible. There was another girl that she was 13, just a pretty little girl. But about 2 years, she'd been normal up until 2 years ago, and all of a sudden she had had trouble walking and talking, and like she was becoming paralyzed and losing her speech. And she had been to doctors and stuff, and no diagnosis. She had not had any diagnosis. And they just said, there's nothing we can do. We don't know what's wrong. So Matt was pursuing that to see if he thought maybe she had muscular dystrophy or something. So he was kind of pursuing that to see if we could get her to a doctor, possibly in the States. So there's a lot we can do with the medical stuff, too, if it works out that we go back, need some organization. And just, it doesn't have to be doctors, just people that can take blood pressures, that can, check people in, that can do a triage of, because so many people come just to get pain medicine. They hurt here and they hurt there. They want to store up some pain medicine for when they're hurting, and that's a lot of it. But there are some people with serious things that need to be seen. Well, so we do the medical clinics, then we do the seminar at night. After we got through with the seminar about 9:30 or so, the daughters, about 15, 16 years old, would head back into the kitchen. And they would go to work. And they would bake bread. They would make cookies. I'm talking, this isn't stuff out of the freezer. And by the time we were kind of sitting down with tea for a social time, these girls would come out with, just tray loads of stuff they had just made in the kitchen. All this like breads with hollowed out and stuff inside and the seeds on top. And they had just, and you could tell they were in training, that their mothers were, they were in training for learning how to do all this stuff. And they were just, but it was not a negative thing. It was, they were just joyfully serving us. And they just, it was, in the whole culture, it's kind of like that. But then after they made all our food and got all that, then they would sit down on the floor and get the cards out, and they want us to play. And they had this game that they played called Papas. And you have to remember, now we're not communicating very well unless Soner is in the room. Matt had gotten to where he could do pretty good with the language. But if they left the room, as Carlton was saying, you could think you're talking to them because you're communicating and everything's going on. But they walk out of the room and you're like, all of a sudden there's a wall. Like, I can't talk to these people. There's 10 people sitting in the room staring at me. And some of them continue talking to me like I know what they're saying. So we sit down on the floor to play cards. And they have this card game where you try to be the first person out. If you're the first person out, then you get to have punishment for the last person that gets out. And so, and they make each other do these crazy things like you got to sing a song and belly dance, you know. So we had fun with that. But also at night, then we would get into conversations. And we started sharing about what the family, the stuff we talked about with the family. And they were just really open. And one of the guys said that his wife had asked for prayer publicly, that we had prayed for. Like he had said, that's the first time she had ever asked for prayer. The first time she'd ever been open with anything spiritual like that. And so that, we felt like that we really, that was an area that we really needed to make progress in, was with the family, with the men, encouraging their wives and being a support and showing them love. And with all of this, this is something, a few things that really stood out. Just one is their, when was their worship time? The sincerity of the whole body, each person wholeheartedly worshiping and just spontaneously praying. And at this particular body, it was just obvious that there was other leadership. There wasn't just one guy. Is that there were other... He didn't really know enough yet to know to designate them as elders and to give them authority. But they were doing it, though. It was happening. It was not a one-man show. And that was really encouraging to see that. It's just that he just needs just a little bit of teaching to know how to apply some of the things a little deeper that he's already doing. The other thing was hospitality and body life, the way that they interacted together. It was just, it was a real challenge to us. And some of the things that I came away with it from there is the Lord really impressed on me that where we are with the study of the family is right where we need to be. I saw this in missionaries. I saw it in the Turkish churches. Everywhere, that I think particularly for the men, that there needed to be a wholeheartedness, but they needed to listen to their wives. I don't know why this stood out so much to me. There need to be, it's like you got this guy just charging ahead full speed, and he's doing all this stuff, but he's leaving his family behind. And that his wife had something to say that was worthwhile for him to hear. But a lot, because of their culture, they could not hear what their wives were telling them. But I saw this in the American missionaries too. And it just compounded to me where we are and what we need to do as a body is that we really need to take care of our families. Not just for the sake of taking care of our families, but to take care of our families to prepare us to do what God has called us to do. And, you know, I'm not sure if y'all are trying the stuff that we have talked about. And I'll give you some more opportunities to put those things in application to narrow down what you need to do. But, you know, for me, that as I have been trying to put those things into practice, to practice the language of love, it's like it really makes a difference. It really has made a difference for me. And so I really believe that where we are with this, this is where God has us with this, to make sure that we are communicating, that we have unity, but we're not just sitting in one spot either, that we're moving ahead with it, that our purpose is the Great Commission as a family, but yet there is unity and there's love happening. Sonar shared, I'd asked him to share on the day that I taught about the family, is what brought him to God? Here's this guy living in a completely almost Muslim nation that he's not perfect, but he really has a heart for God. He really has a heart for making disciples. How did this happen with him? You know, how can we see it happen here? And the thing that he shared with me was he said it wasn't the arguing between Christianity and Muslim that brought him to God. He was taking Taekwondo or something from a Korean guy that was living in Turkey. And the guy had invited him over to his home. And when he went into his home, he saw the love between the husband and wife and between how the parents love their kids. And they showed this love just in their interaction in the family. And he said, that's what brought him to God. He saw that, and he said, that's what I want. That's what I want. I've never known love before. I've never been shown love, and I want that. And that was the first thing that opened the door for him to come to know the Lord. And I just see this over and over as a foundation for the building of the church, is that we need to give this some attention. The other part, the other thing that I saw is balance. Not just in the home with listening to each other and receiving input, but also in the body, that it's our very strengths and weaknesses that weld us together. You know, I could see one leader that was so strong and talented, but his weakness was destroying him. All he needed was somebody to fit with him that had a strength in that area. That's all he needed. But if he didn't hear that and wouldn't receive it, he's basically doing damage while he's going about the ministry. And the same thing within the body, that it's so, instead of seeing weaknesses in the body and strengths in the body as something that holds us together, instead of doing that, what we do is get critical. We see a weakness in somebody else, and our first, we're just blind to the fact that we have our own weaknesses. Nobody is without weaknesses. When what God does in the body is He takes those weaknesses and He takes the strengths and He fits them together, and it's like, it's better than if everybody was strong. Because now we have to depend on each other. And if we could do anything, I think we start with starting with the family, and we're working on that. And we're going to give you some concrete things to work on there. But also within the body is that we quit being critical of each other. We do away with that. And we see the weaknesses in each other. We see them. We don't deny them. We see them. But we see how that weakness, when I see a weakness, I may have a strength in that area. But instead of being critical, is that we see clearly that welds us together to need each other and to bring unity to the body rather than division. And these two things, along with the teaching of the Word, is what I saw that brought people out of the darkness of Islam. And I mean, I'm not ashamed to tell you, it is dark and it is oppressive. It's blinding. But I saw these things bring people out of that darkness. The love in the family. And I'm not saying there's not discipline there, okay? There has to be discipline. We're going to talk about that. But the love in the family, unity in the family, and unity in the body and the Word, the teaching of the Word. Those things together were what brought people out of the darkness of Islam to come to know the Lord. And they were not afraid to reach out. They were not afraid to be seen by that world. They let their light be seen. And that was a real challenge to us. And, you know, I'll say this quietly, but there were a lot of similarities between there and here. It's not as drastic. It's not as obvious. But there were a lot of similarities. And a lot of things that we can learn from. And it's not about beating people down. It's about loving people. It's about reaching out in compassion and mercy and not being afraid of being rejected. Because they weren't. Their rejection wasn't just verbal rejection sometimes. It was a little more serious. But it's a challenge. And they were not discouraged by it being one or two people at the time. They were encouraged by that. If it was one or two people here and one or two people there, just gradually making progress, making inroads. And they were happy. They were happy with that. So let's read two verses. And I would like for you to take these verses and maybe have some quiet time with these and see what God is teaching us through this. Ken or Carlton, is there anything as I share with you guys that you feel like I need to bring out that I didn't talk about? John 17:20 is where we'll go first. John 17:20-23. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. All of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I and them and you and me. May they be brought to complete unity to let the world know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. and 2 Corinthians 2:14. But thanks be to God, who always leads us in triumphal procession in Christ, and through us spreads everywhere the fragrance of the knowledge of Him. For we are to God the aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and those who are perishing. To one we are the smell of death, to the other the fragrance of life. And who is equal to such a task? I think we need to all, first of all, before we try to do anything in Turkey, is we need to be doing it here. We need to be good examples in our families and being willing to take risk and reaching out to the world and take and be willing to fail before we succeed, if that's the case. And I think to assess if we are called to Turkey, where I would see us, what I would see us doing in Turkey, if we go back this summer, if that's what God would have us to do, is scattered across Turkey as we're kind of picking up bits and pieces here, are these small fellowships of Turkish believers that have no contact with the West, that have no access to training, to teach, to understanding and how to teach the Word. And we're already aware of two fellowships like this. The one we went to, and then another one outside of Ankara. So, for us to give them a solid plan for teaching the Word, for building up the body, for training leaders, and tools to do that with. And also to open the doors of relationship with medical clinics and that sort of thing, if that's what God would have us to do. So, that's what you can be praying about. And certainly I'm open to your input there. Any questions about what happened in Turkey or what didn't happen in Turkey? I had the pleasure of an 11-hour bus ride because Salim talked Soner and Matt into staying another couple of days because he just did not want us to leave. He said, "We do not get this training. We want more. You've got to stay and teach some more." I said, "My plane's leaving. I got to go." And so they put me on a bus 11 hours across Turkey back to Ankara. The next day, about 35 hours worth of flying. But it was fun. Ken? Yeah, those were the things that impacted. That was having an impact. Was teaching the Word and showing love. And you'll see a book back there that Dan Wickwire, a little pamphlet, really that he, one of them that he wrote, and it's has the Bible really changed as Muslims say it has? And that's just a common attack. Is they say, yeah, we accept the Bible as the holy book, but it hadn't been it's been changed, so we can't really believe it. So they kind of cancel that out. But it's, their arguments are pretty shallow. It's not too hard to refute them. So we feel like that the plan that we have fits into this, you know, and we're open to change, but carrying on with the firm foundations and building up our families and being willing to take a chance, show love to the world, unity.